There was something, the wooden handle of a spear, sticking out of the wall. The wood and iron spear looked so out of place. Here in a room of strange metal and glass and technology, David couldn't begin to imagine. On the other side of the room, a hologram flickered to life, like a 3D video of some sort.
What is...
We don't know for sure, Craig said. He walked closer to the area where the hologram was forming. Some sort of videos, holograms, on repeat. They play every few minutes. I think they show the past. What happened here? They're the other reason I brought you down here, to this room. They are the secrets this room holds. We think Patrick Pierce hadn't yet uncovered them when he sent the journal in 1938. Or, this is another theory, he had found the room, but nothing worked until he came out of the tube in 1978. We're still sorting it out. But as you'll see, we believe he saw them at some point in the 7 years after he resumed his work as Tom Warner. We don't know what they mean yet, but he went to great lengths to keep them from us. We think they're some kind of message. Chapter 116. Imari Research Base Prism, East Antarctica. Kate looked up at the sound of the second explosion. She tried the door again, still locked. She thought she smelled smoke. Her mind raced through Dorian's crazed allegations and the videos of the children walking into that massive structure, with the packs strapped to their backs. The door swung open, and Martin Gray stepped quickly into the room. He grabbed Kate by the arm and pulled her out into the hall. "Martin," Kate began, but he cut her off. "Stay quiet. We have to hurry," Martin said, as he led her down the white-walled corridor. They turned a corner, and the corridor ended in what looked like an airlock on a space station. They proceeded through the airlock, and a gust rushed past them as they ventured into the large room beyond, some sort of hangar or warehouse with a high arched ceiling. Martin squeezed her arm and led her to a stack of hard plastic crates, where they knelt and waited in silence. She heard men's voices at the end of the room, and the engines of heavy equipment. Forklifts, maybe. "Stay here," Martin said.
"Martin?"
"In a minute," Martin whispered, as he got to his feet and began walking quickly. Kate heard his footfalls stop abruptly as he reached the men. His voice rang with an authority and force Kate had never before heard from her adoptive father.
"What the hell are you doing?"
"Unloading.
Sloan has called for all personnel at the north entrance."
"What?"
"We were told the station has been breached. If it falls, whatever you're doing here won't matter. He called for you. You can stay here if you like. It's your funeral."
Kate heard more footfalls moving toward her. Then they passed her and moved out another airlock. There was just one set of footfalls now. Martin's. He walked deeper into the hangar and spoke again.
"He's called for everyone."
"Who's going to control the site?
Gentlemen, why do you think I'm here?"
More footfalls, running, an airlock opening and closing, and Martin was back.
"Come quickly, Kate."
Martin marched her past rows of crates and a makeshift control station of some kind, with a bank of computers and a wall of screens. They showed a long ice corridor and the opening she had seen the children walk through.
"Please, Martin, tell me what's going on."
Martin's eyes were soft, sympathetic. "Get into the suit. I'll tell you all I can in the seconds we have left." He motioned to a white, puffy spacesuit hanging on the wall beside a group of lockers. Kate began slipping into the suit, and Martin looked away from her as he spoke.
"I'm so sorry, Kate. I'm the one that forced you to produce results, and when you did, I had the children kidnapped. I did it because we needed them."
"The bell."
"Yes, to get past the bell. To get inside the tombs. The structure 2 miles below the ice here in Antarctica. Since we began studying the bell, we've known some people can resist it longer than others. They all die, but a few years ago we identified a set of genes involved in resistance. The Atlantis gene, we call it. The gene heavily influences brain wiring.
We think it's responsible for all sorts of advanced cognitive abilities, problem-solving, advanced reasoning, language, creativity. We, Homo sapiens, that is, have it. And none of the other subspecies of humans have it. Not that we've found. It's how we're different. My theory is that the Atlanteans gave it to us around 60,000 years ago, around the time of the Toba catastrophe. It's what enabled us to survive, but we weren't quite ready for it. We were still very much like our great ape cousins, acting on instinct, living in the wild. The strange thing is, we think it's activated by a sort of neural survival subroutine, the fight-or-flight center of the brain. That mechanism activates the Atlantis gene, focusing the mind and body. It could be why we're a race of thrill-seekers and why we're so prone to violence. It's fascinating. Martin shook his head, trying to focus. Anyway, we're still trying to understand how it works. Everyone has the Atlantis gene, or at least some of the genetic components for it. But activating the gene is the problem. For some minds, geniuses, activation is more frequent. We think these genius moments, these flashes of insight and clarity, are literally like a light bulb flickering on and off. The Atlantis gene activates, and for the briefest of moments, we can use the full power of our minds. These people can activate the Atlantis gene without the fight-or-flight circuit breaker. We began focusing our research on minds that had this sort of sustained activation. We observed activation in some minds on the autism spectrum, savants. That's why we funded your research. It's why the Amari Council forgave Dorian's transgressions with you. He had steered you into an area of Amari interest. And when you succeeded, when the children showed sustained Atlantis gene activation, I took the kids before he could find out. I created other distractions, with Clock Tower, to keep him busy. You were the source. You sent the information to David. Yes, it was a desperate attempt to stop Toba Protocol. I knew David had been investigating the Amari conspiracy. I sent him a message revealing the Amari double agents working as Clock Tower analysts, and I was trying to tell him that Clock Tower itself was the Amari intelligence agency, to warn him about who to trust. I had hoped he could learn the truth in time. I had to be very careful, though. Some of the information was only known at the highest level, and I was already under suspicion. At the very least, I hoped the war for Clock Tower would consume the Amari, delaying the execution of Toba Protocol. What exactly is Toba Protocol? Toba is Sloane's plan, to use the plague from the Bell to complete the genetic transformation of the human race. Why? To synchronize us, genetically, with the Atlanteans. At least that's the story Sloane and Keegan sell throughout the organization. But that's only half the truth. His real endgame is to create an army for a preemptive strike. Sloane and Keegan want to enter the structure below us and kill the Atlanteans. That's insane. Yes. But in their time, in 1918, the outbreak killed tens of millions worldwide, including Sloane's mother and brother. They believe whoever is inside this structure means us harm, that they will exterminate the human race when they awaken. To them, saving a select few, a genetically superior group, is better than extinction. Questions raced through Kate's mind. She tried to process Martin's revelations. "Why didn't you tell me? Why not ask for my help?" she asked, almost without thinking. Martin sighed. "To protect you. And I needed the children quickly. I didn't have time to explain, and doing so would have involved you in the Amari conspiracy. I was trying to fulfill a promise I made a long time ago, to keep you out of this. But I failed. The ops team was supposed to quietly take the children from your lab. You weren't supposed to even be there at that hour. I was horrified when I heard that your assistant had been killed, and I made other mistakes. I underestimated how quickly Dorian would react. I tried to give you clues about what was going on when we met in Jakarta, during my theatrical rant in the observation room. I wasn't sure you could put it all together. Then Dorian's men had you, and the entire situation spun out of control. After I saw you in Jakarta, I was taken here to Antarctica. Dorian's agents have been watching me. There wasn't much I could do to help you, but I had an agent of my own here, Naomi. I risked sending another coded message to David, telling him about the China facility, and Naomi found a way to accompany Dorian there. Naomi arranged for the ID badges at the train station. Yes. My hope was that between her, you, and David, the three of you could rescue the children and disable the power plant, preventing Toba Protocol. It was a long shot, a desperate move, but given the stakes, literally billions of lives, any chance was better than none. Kate pulled the last of the bulky suit on.
The boys.
You were trying to make contact. I'm part of a small faction within the Amari that favors a different path. Our goal has been to find a therapy that activated the Atlantis gene, allowing us to enter the tombs and greet the Atlanteans as they awaken, not as murderers, but as their children. To ask their help in managing humanity's growing pains. To ask for their help with fixing the Atlantis gene. We found some other interesting aspects of the gene. Mysteries we still don't understand. There isn't time to explain, but we need their help. That's what you have to do, Kate. You can cross into the tombs. You've seen what Dorian's plan is, to use the children to annihilate the Atlanteans. You must hurry. Your father gave his life for this cause, and he made so many sacrifices for you, and he tried so desperately to save your mother.
My mother?
Kate struggled to understand. Martin shook his head. Of course, I haven't told you. The journal. It's your father's.
It can't be.
Kate searched Martin's face. Her mother was Helena Barton? Patrick Pierce was her father? How could it be true?
It's true.
He was a reluctant member of the Amari. He did it to save you. He put you in the tube inside your mother that day in the field hospital in Gibraltar. He emerged in 1978 and took the name Tom Warner. I was already a staff scientist for the Amari, but I was wavering. The methods, the cruelty. I found in him an ally, someone inside the organization who wanted to stop the madness, someone who favored dialogue over genocide. But he never trusted me, not fully. Martin stared at the floor. I've tried so hard to keep you safe, to honor my promise to him, but I've failed so miserably. Behind them, another explosion rocked the facility. Martin grabbed the helmet to the suit. You have to hurry. I'll lower you down. When you get inside, you have to find the children and lead them out first. Whatever you do, make sure they get out. Then find the Atlanteans. There isn't much time left. Less than 30 minutes until the bombs the boys are carrying go off. He ushered her to another airlock at the end of the warehouse. When you get outside, climb into the basket. I can operate it from here. When it reaches the bottom of the ice shaft, run through the portal, just as the children did. He locked the suit helmet in place and pushed her out of the airlock before Kate could say another word. When the outer airlock opened, Kate saw the iron basket hanging from the crane's thick metal cord. It swayed slightly as the Antarctic winds blew through it, barely catching the iron mesh on the sides. She waddled over to it with some effort. The wind almost blew her over as she reached it. The handle was hard to work with her fat fingers, but she managed to get inside. As soon as she closed the door, it began descending into the round hole. The basket creaked, and above her the round circle of light shrank with every passing second. It reminded Kate of the end of a cartoon, where the final scene is gradually covered with black as the circle shrinks to the size of a pin and finally winks out into full black. The squeaking basket was an unnerving soundtrack to the darkening descent. After a few moments, the basket began moving faster, and the last sliver of light above disappeared. The speed and disorienting darkness gave her a sick feeling in her stomach, and she braced herself against the basket. Not much longer, she told herself, but she had no idea. It was 2 miles deep. Then there was light, a smattering of faint sparkles below, like stars shining on a clear night. For a moment, Kate gazed down at them, admiring their beauty, not thinking about what they actually were. Stars, she thought. Then her scientific mind slowly, subtly began rifling through the possibilities before settling on the most likely candidate, tiny LED lights that had been dropped to illuminate the bottom of the hole. They lay there in a random pattern, glowing in the blackness around them, as if guiding Kate on a cosmic journey to some unknown planet. They were almost entrancing. A loud sound, an explosion, echoed down through the shaft, and Kate felt the basket falling faster, and faster still. The thick cable attached at the top of the basket grew slack and gathered in waves above her. She was falling, free-falling. The cable had been cut. Chapter 117. Imari Tunnels, Gibraltar. Craig stepped closer to David as the hologram formed. David stared at it. The colors were vivid, and the hologram almost filled the room. It felt like he was there. He saw a massive ship rising out of the ocean. The Rock of Gibraltar came into view, and David realized the scale of the machine. The rock looked like a pebble next to it. There was something else. The location of the rock was wrong. It was inland, not on the coast, and the land extended beyond the rock and to the right of it, all the way to Africa. Europe and Africa, joined by a land bridge. "My God," David whispered. Craig paced closer to David. "It's just as Plato described it. A massive island rising out of the sea. We're still trying to nail down the time period, but we think this hollow movie was made about 12,000 to 15,000 years ago. It was certainly some point before the last ice age ended. We'll know more as soon as we estimate the sea level. Plato's account says the island sank 12,500 years ago, so that could be about right. And you've noticed the size of the vessel. Incredible. You've only found a piece." "Yes, and a small one at that. We think the structure is over 60 square miles, that is, assuming the rock is the same size today as it was 15,000 years ago. The structure, or piece, as you say, that we stand in now is less than 1 square mile. The vessel in Antarctica is much larger, about 250 square miles. Craig nodded to the hologram. "The next movie reveals what this vessel is, we think." David watched the massive ship move to the shore and stop. The hologram flickered, as if someone were changing the reel in an antique movie projector. The ship was still there, but the water had risen some. Just above the ship, on the edge of the coast, there was a city, if you could call it that. Primitive stone monuments, like a series of stone hinges, radiated out from the ship in semicircles. Huts with thatched roofs dotted the landscape. A huge bonfire burned in the middle of the stone structures, and the hologram zoomed in. A band of humans wearing thick furs was dragging another human. No, an ape. Or something in between. The ape was tall. He was naked and fought wildly at the captors at his sides. The humans around him bowed as he neared the fire. From the ship, two flying objects launched. They looked like chariots or space-age segways. They floated a few feet above the ground, racing toward the fire. When they reached it, the humans backed away, bowing and facing the ground. The Atlanteans dismounted their chariots, grabbed the savage, and injected him with something. They wore some sort of body armor with helmets covered almost entirely by mirrored glass, except the rear part. They threw the ape man across a chariot and rushed back to the ship. The hologram flickered again, and the scene changed to the inside of the ship. The ape man lay on the floor. The Atlanteans were still in their suits, and David couldn't tell, but it seemed as if they were saying something to each other. The subtle body language, a few hand gestures. Craig cleared his throat. "We're still scratching our heads on this one. Bear in mind we only saw them a few hours ago when we got the map from the journal and accessed the chamber, but we think this is a video of the Atlanteans interrupting a ritual sacrifice. The man is a Neanderthal, We think our ancestors considered it their duty to hunt down every man not made in the image of God and sacrifice him. Some sort of early racial cleansing. Is it the same early human that Pierce saw in the tube? Yes, as you'll see. What happened to it? Craig snorted and shook his head. Cain thawed him in the early 30s, the second he had the bell operational. We had a time with the power supply. They ran a series of experiments over a few years. They even tried to recreate the ape man by breeding humans with chimpanzees. His insane Humanzi project. Cain finally lost interest when there was no progress. He fed him to the bell in 34. He didn't survive? No, even after countless thousands of years in the tube. So of course we were shocked when Kate Warner did. We think it has something to do with the tubes, but whatever it does only works on our subspecies. The tubes must somehow activate the Atlantis gene. Whatever she treated the children with has to be connected to the tubes in some way. Our theory is that every human has the Atlantis gene, but it's only activated sporadically, and by a select few. Clearly the Neanderthal didn't have the genetic precursor. Craig nodded to the hologram. Oh, here's the money shot, as they say. The image moved out of the lab to an outdoor shot again. Behind the ship, a massive tsunami rose in the air. It must have been 100 feet taller than the ship, which itself could have easily been 200 feet tall, based on its height relative to the Rock of Gibraltar. The wave washed over the ship and into the primitive city, destroying it in one violent sweep. The ship was adrift, and the wave carried it into the city, flattening the stone monuments and huts as it went. Then the waters receded, dragging the ship out to sea, more than half of it still underwater. Sparks flew along the bottom as the ship skidded against the seafloor below it. Then the hologram flashed red and white as a massive explosion erupted below the ship, ripping it into 2, 3, now 4 pieces. We think it was a giant methane pocket on the seabed. It exploded with the force of 12 nuclear warheads. The water was rushing back over the broken ship, and the image returned to the lab and the Atlanteans. One of them had been thrown against the bulkhead. The body was limp. Dead? The surviving Atlantean hoisted the Neanderthal like a rag doll and shoved him into a tube. His strength was amazing. David wondered if it was the suit or his natural strength. The Atlantean turned to his partner and hoisted him up. The image winked out as the man left the room. The hologram followed him as he ran through the ship. He was thrown about, no doubt as the waves rocked the ship and it floated lifelessly to the bottom of the sea. Then he was in the chamber where Craig and David now stood. He worked the panels for a moment. He didn't actually touch the controls. He merely worked his fingers above them as he held his partner on his shoulder. The computers shut down one by one. We think he's activating the bell here, an anti-intrusion device to keep animals like us out. It makes sense. Then he powers off the computers. We're still scratching our heads at this next part. On the hologram, the room was almost dark except for the faint glow of emergency lights. The man stepped to the rear of the room and touched something on his forearm. A door slid open before him. David followed it with his eyes. The door was there, but it had the spear in it now. The Atlantean looked around, paused, and walked through. The door shut behind him, with no spear in it. David looked back to the door. "Don't bother," Craig shook his head. "We've tried for hours now." "What's in the door?" David stepped closer to it. "Not sure. A couple of scientists think it's the Spear of Destiny, but we're not certain. We think Patrick, or rather, Tom Warner, had it down here, trying to cut a hole in the door or something." David edged closer. The Spear of Destiny? David knew what it was, but he needed to buy some time and distract Craig. "Yes, you don't know it?" David shook his head. Cain was obsessed with it. And Hitler after him. The legend is that the spear was stabbed into the side of Jesus Christ as he hung on the cross, killing him. The ancients believed that any army that possessed the spear could never be defeated. When Hitler annexed Austria, he took the spear, and he only lost it a few weeks before Germany surrendered. It's one of the many artifacts we collected over the years, hoping it, or anything else from antiquity, would provide clues to the Atlanteans.
Interesting, David said, as he grabbed the end of the spear. He pulled at it, and he felt the door move slightly. He pulled harder. The spear came free, and the door opened. He dropped the cane and lunged through the doorway as Craig pulled his gun out and began firing.
Chapter 118. Imari Research Base Prism, East Antarctica.
No, don't shoot them! Dorian yelled into the radio, but it was too late.
He watched the second man take two shots to the chest, and the third fall from shots to the shoulder and abdomen.
Stop firing! I will shoot the next idiot who pulls the trigger!
The gunshot ceased, and Dorian walked out into the open space toward the last man. At the sight of Dorian, he began crawling for his gun, leaving a trail of thick blood as he went. Dorian jogged to the gun and kicked it to the far wall of the lab.
Stop. I don't want to hurt you. In fact, I'll get you some help. I just want to know who sent you.
Sent me?
The man coughed, and blood ran down his chin.
Yes.
Dorian's earpiece crackled, and he looked away from the dying man. One of the station techs came on.
Sir, we've ID'd the men. They're ours. One of the drill teams.
A drill team?
Yes, they're actually the team that found the entrance.
Dorian turned back to the man.
Who sent you?
The man looked confused.
Nobody sent us.
I don't believe you.
I saw...
The man was losing more blood now. The shot in the gut would do him in soon.
Saw what?
Dorian pressed.
Children.
Oh, for God's sake, Dorian said. What was the world coming to? Even oil rig operators were bleeding heart softies these days? He raised the gun and shot the man in the head. He turned and walked back to his Imari security unit.
Clean this up.
Sir, something's happening in portal control. The soldier looked up. Someone just launched the basket.
Dorian's eyes drifted toward the floor, then darted back and forth.
Martin, send a team. Secure the control station. No one leaves that room.
A thought ran through Dorian's mind. The basket was launched?
Kate.
How much time?
Time?
The bombs the children are carrying.
The Imari security agent took out a tablet and tapped at it.
Less than 15 minutes.
She might still reach them.
Cut the cord on the basket,
Dorian said. It was a fitting end. Kate Warner, Patrick Pierce's daughter, would die in a cold, dark tunnel, just as Dorian's brother, Rutger, had.
Chapter 119.
David fell to the floor as the bullets ricocheted off the door closing behind him. He spun around, crouched, and held the spear point forward over his shoulder, like some prehistoric hunter ready to stick his prey when it emerged from the sliding door. But the door didn't open. David exhaled and sat down on the floor, giving the wounded leg a rest. He didn't see how Patrick Pierce had done it, all the walking around down here. When the pain subsided, he got to his feet and took in his surroundings. The room was similar to the one he had just left. The iron-gray walls were the same, and so were the lights at the top and bottom of them. The room seemed to be a lobby of some sort. It had 7 doors in all, fanning out in a semicircle, almost like a bank of elevator doors. Other than the 7 oval sliding doors, the room was almost empty, save for a chest-high table opposite the bank of doors. A control station? The surface was covered in dark plastic or glass that matched the controls in the previous chamber. David stepped up to the desk and leaned the spear against it so he could use his good hand. He held his hand over the surface like he had seen the Atlantean do in the hologram. Wisps of white and blue fog and light whirled around his hand, giving him tiny electric pops and shocks. He wiggled his fingers, and the light and fog changed radically, the pops and slight electric impulses swirling all over his fingers. David drew the hand back. Talk about being out of your element. He had half expected, or rather hoped, that some sort of help menu would pop up. He picked the spear back up. Stick to what you know. Your hunter-gatherer ways, he told himself. There was another door, set off by itself, next to the control station. An exit? He walked to it, and it slid open, revealing more of the Star Trek-type iron corridors that had led to the Tunnel Maker's secret chamber. His eyes had now fully adjusted to the faint LED lights that ran along the floor and ceiling. If the Atlanteans had run to this room when the ship had exploded 12 to 15,000 years ago, it stood to reason that this was some kind of escape pod, or maybe a fortified section in the middle of the ship. Another thought popped into David's mind. If they had come here, some of them could still be here. Maybe they had hibernated here, in other tubes. David looked around. There were certainly no signs of life. The elevator room opened into a T-intersection. Both directions ended in another oval door. He chose the shorter path and limped along, using the spear as a walking staff. It helped immensely. At the end of the corridor, the door slid open automatically, and David stepped through.
"Don't move!"
A man's voice. It was hoarse, as if he hadn't spoken in a while. David heard a footfall behind him. Based on the echo, the man, or Atlantean, was about his size. David raised his arms, still holding the spear. "I'm not here to hurt you."
"I said, don't move."
The man was almost upon him. David turned quickly, catching a glimpse, a flash of the man, or whatever it was, just before he felt the electric prod dig into him. It sent him to the ground and into unconsciousness. Chapter 120. 2 miles below Imari Research Base Prism, East Antarctica. The iron basket wobbled as it hurtled down the ice shaft. It drifted over and cut into the smooth ice wall, spraying shards of ice all over Kate's suit and visor. She raised her arms to cover her helmet just as the basket lurched back, almost throwing her out. The heavy cable that had bunched above the basket was weighing on it. The basket steadied for a moment, then tipped in one quick motion, the bottom cutting into one side of the ice shaft, the top carving the other. Kate grabbed a bar at the top of the basket and dug her feet into the iron mesh floor, locking herself in like an astronaut in a zero-G training hoop, preparing in case the basket flipped end over end and side to side. She closed her eyes and pushed against the basket with all the strength she could muster, and waited. More ice sprayed around her as the basket bounced against the sides of the tunnel. The impacts were slowing the fall. Then the walls disappeared, and 2 long seconds passed, and crunch! The basket dug into a mound of ice, and Kate was plowed into the ground, knocking the wind out of her. She fought to suck a breath inside the suit. It was like breathing through a tiny coffee straw. When she had regained her breath, she rolled over and took stock of her situation. The basket had dug several feet into a mound of ice just below where the drill had punched through the chamber. It must have been the ice shards that had fallen down the shaft as the drill was extracted back to the surface, and the ice spray from her descent. The bed of ice had saved her life. The mound looked more like a snow globe. Bright lights glowed deep within. Kate stared at them for a moment. They looked almost like a flock of fireflies, but they were no doubt the LEDs that had been dropped to illuminate the vast cavern below. They had sunk deep into the chips of ice, and their light refracted out and into the large chamber. They also revealed Kate's situation. The basket was about half buried in the loose chips of ice, and the part above the surface of the mound was covered in iron mesh. She was trapped. But there was a small opening, not large enough to crawl out of, but she could make it larger if she dug under it. Kate began digging with her hands, like a dog trying to get under a chain-link fence. The iron cage had broken up the finely shaved ice a bit, but it was still slow going. Finally, she thought the opening was large enough, and she dove headfirst under it. Her head and arms were through, but the bulky suit caught against the jagged iron mesh. Kate tried to pull back, but the sharp mesh ripped the suit and held her tight. Cold air rushed in through the hole in the suit, assaulting her back as she wiggled to get free. She pressed her belly into the ice as hard as she could and pushed back with her hands, and she was back in the cage. The cold seemed to be numbing her body, bit by bit, starting with her back and radiating outward. With each passing second, it claimed more of her body. Her hands began to shake. The suit had provided more warmth than she'd realized. It was deathly cold down here. She would freeze to death if she didn't act fast. She began scooping the ice with both hands, frantically trying to enlarge the hole. She felt her legs grow stiff, and she fought to balance as she heaved another handful of ice into the basket. The hole was almost there. The cold air burned her lungs now, and her breath was an icy fog against the clear glass helmet. Soon the cold would overtake her lungs. She would suffocate to death before she froze. The fog, it had almost covered the helmet. She wiped it with her hand. Nothing. It was still there. She wiped again. Still there. Why wouldn't it go away? Of course, it was on the inside of the helmet. She knew that. Why did she even try to wipe the outside of the helmet? What was happening to her? The cold. Shutting down her body, she could barely think. What was she doing before the fog? The sheet of ice inside the helmet was complete now. She couldn't see a thing. She turned around, searching for some kind of direction, like a dog in a cage, on all fours, searching for a sound in the night. A dog. A cage. The hole. Yes, she was digging to get out. She had to get out. Where was the hole? Kate felt desperately at the ice below her. She scampered around the cage. Nothing but mesh, everywhere. Was there a hole? Then her hands felt something. Yes, it was there. But she couldn't dig any more. She couldn't feel her fingers. She dove into the hole and pushed with her feet. She felt the sharp metal mesh on her back, but she ignored it, pushing even harder with her feet. The mesh was on the backs of her legs now. She was moving. She dug her elbows into the ice and pulled, one elbow over the other like a soldier crawling under a barbed wire obstacle course. How far had she gone? She kicked a leg up. She was free. She rolled over and got to her feet. She could see only the wall of fog that had turned to ice on the inside of her helmet. Which way was the structure? She started to run, but her legs felt like they were made of lead. The suit, plus her frozen legs, she would never make it. She was getting nowhere. Which direction should she walk? It was all the same. Ice and beyond, the faint glow of lights. She felt the ground rushing up. She was lying on the ground, rolling. The ice touched her back, sending a new wave of cold into her body, shocking her system. She arched her back and her eyes opened wide. She sucked in a breath and bounded onto her knees, breathing heavily. She had to think. She got to her feet and spun around. Lights. There were more in one direction than the other. She spun around again. Where would there be more lights? The domed chamber was massive. The lights, the snow globe, the fireflies inside, where the drill had come through, the lights would be in the opposite direction from the entrance. Kate turned and waddled away from the light. She was so cold. Then there was a boom, the drone of metal on metal. It was ahead, but slightly to her right. Kate adjusted her vector and kept pressing forward. She fell again, but pushed up, putting both hands on one knee and dragging her other leg up. She couldn't feel any part of her body anymore. She was simply swinging her limbs, hoping for a break. The crunch, crunch, crunch of ice below her feet stopped. Her footsteps had quieted, but it was still cold. She was lightheaded. She took another step, then another. Keep walking. Behind her, metal on metal. The door closing? She was still so cold. She fell to her knees and then to the ground, face first. Chapter 121. Imari Research Base Prism, East Antarctica. Dorian watched Kate fall, then get up and wander into the giant portal. The bell hanging above was silent. He glanced over at the countdown clock. 1 minute, 32 seconds. Less than 2 minutes. He had been sure the fall would kill her, but a nuclear blast inside the tombs? Just as good. Same end result.
"Release me, Dorian."
Dorian turned and eyed Martin Gray. The gray-haired man struggled against the Imari security agents who held him at each side. Dorian had been so obsessed with watching Kate die, or so he had hoped, that he had forgotten the old buzzard was still in the control room. Dorian turned to Martin and smiled.
"It was you. The whole charade with Clock Tower, then guiding them to the China facility, hoping they would save the children and stop me from executing Toba Protocol," he thought for a moment. "And you helped them escape. It was you, wasn't it? You contacted the Amaru, who rescued them after the bell exploded. How did you know? How did you find them?"
"You're delusional, Dorian. Release me and stop embarrassing yourself."
"You're very clever, Martin, but you can't talk your way out of this one. You just helped Kate escape."
"I don't deny it. I have never hidden my love for her. Protecting her is my first priority. I would have burned this facility to the ground if I had to." Dorian smiled. "So you admit it. The drill team that attacked us was acting on your orders." Martin shook his head dismissively. "Absolutely not. Think about it, Dorian. I don't even have a way to contact them. I've never so much as met them."
"Well, it doesn't matter. I've figured it out, Martin."
Dorian studied the older man, waiting for a reaction.
"Have you?" "Yes, I bet you have. The children survived the bell because they were treated with stem cells from Kate's and my child. Both of us were saved by the tubes. Kate, as an unborn fetus in her mother's womb, myself as a child suffering from the Atlantis plague, or Spanish flu, if you like, which means I can walk through that portal as well. But I'm going to wait a few minutes." He motioned to the giant computer screen with the countdown. The last few seconds ticked off until it read 00000. The letters flashed in red. Dorian had expected some tremors on the surface from the explosions, but there was nothing. The structure must have impossibly thick walls, and the 2 miles of ice provided additional insulation. Dorian smiled. 2 nuclear warheads just went off down there. Kate didn't make it to the children, I can assure you. She had less than 2 minutes to reach them, and I think she was in no shape for a foot race. You saw it. She suffered a great deal, Martin. She may have frozen to death inside the suit, or at the very least, lost most of her fingers and toes right before she died. That was very cruel of you. Dorian waited, but Martin said nothing. Dorian nodded to one of his security officers, who moved to the lockers and began readying a spacesuit. "I'm going to go down there and check on her shortly, as soon as they rig up a harness to lower me. I'll let you know if we find any remains. I doubt it. But before I go, I want to share something else. I figured out another mystery." Dorian paced in front of him. "Do you care to hear it?"
"It's your freak show, Dorian."
"Don't insult me.
I hold your life in my hands. And your own. No council member can kill another."
"We'll see about that. Mallory Craig forbade me from killing you a few days ago, but he's come around now. He sent Kate to me. He won't veto your execution this time. But as I was saying, the explosion in China. The children were simply treated with the Atlantis gene therapy. The bell radiation didn't harm them, but it acted differently when Kate came into contact with it. The bell shut down. That's what happened in China. The bell recognized her as an Atlantean, one of its own, and it shut down.
sending a power surge of overwhelming proportions through our grid, destroying the nuclear reactors and every other relay in the entire facility. Do you realize the implications, Martin?
Martin stared into the distance.
I'm sure you're going to tell me.
Don't be cheeky. You'll want to hear this.
It means our child is the first offspring of two Atlanteans, the first of a new breed of human, the eventuality of human evolution. Its genome holds the clues to understanding how we changed 50,000 years ago, how we can continue evolving.
Could have, Dorian. Your own,
I couldn't do it.
Dorian turned away from Martin.
As much as I hated Kate for what her father did to my family, I couldn't bring myself to kill my own child. It's in a lab, in one of the Atlantean tubes, in San Francisco. That's what I wanted to tell you, Martin. All your meddling, it hasn't accounted to a damn thing.
I've won. A science team is extracting the fetus now for study. We'll have a viable Atlantis vaccine soon, maybe even in a few weeks or months. And we'll use it selectively.
A tech interrupted Dorian.
We're ready, sir.
Gotta go, Martin.
I wouldn't do that if I were you.
Martin stared at him.
I'm sure you would.
I know why you're going down there.
You know?
The note, Martin said, that you pinned on those children. I know what was in it. A letter in German from a hopeful little boy telling his papa that the children were carrying bombs and that he needed to get to an entrance as quickly as possible.
You're blind, Dorian. Look at the facts and the carcasses of those primates in Lab 3. The bell down there was active when we arrived, and so was the one on the iceberg with the sub several weeks ago. It killed the men on our research team, and we found bones below it. Your father never slept in a tube. He was human. Very human indeed.
He was a god.
And he's not dead. I've never seen his bones, Dorian said, defiantly.
Not yet. But we will.
He's down there, Dorian insisted. Even if he is, which I doubt, he would be 127 years old.
Then I'll see his bones or whatever I can find, but I'll know. And I'll see some other bones, female, early 30s, and then I'll finally complete my destiny. I'll remove the Atlantis threat once and for all.
Dorian motioned to the security guards.
Make sure he doesn't get out of here. Heavy guard. And if they don't need him for the research on the fetus,
he turned and looked Martin in the eyes,
then kill him.
Martin's stoic face didn't betray a shred of emotion. One of the technicians walked over and led Dorian aside. He spoke hesitantly.
Sir, about going down there, we think you should wait.
Why?
The suit will protect me from radiation, you said.
Yes, that's true, but there could be other damage from the blasts. Fire, possibly damage to the structure. The entire thing could collapse, for all we know. We're getting some data on the structure in Gibraltar. Director Craig found some sort of archival videos. The structure was actually shattered by methane blasts, similar to the nukes we sent. Well, actually, more powerful. But we know the structures aren't indestructible.
What do you suggest?
Wait a few days.
Out of the question. I'll wait a few hours at most.
The tech nodded.
There's something else. After I enter the tombs, lower three warheads down this drill shaft. If anyone besides me or my father comes out, human, Atlantean, or otherwise, set them off. Deploy the rest of the nukes down the other drill holes and rig them all to detonate simultaneously.
The blasts would melt the ice.
The blasts would save the human race.
Do it. Chapter 122. David opened his eyes and looked around. He was lying on a skinny cot with a gel-like mattress that contoured perfectly to his body. He leaned forward and the gel retracted, helping him up. He smelled something like garlic mixed with licorice. Actually, it was worse than that. David raised his hand to cover his nose, but the smell only got worse.
The stench was coming from him, he suddenly realized. From a black paste on his shoulder and leg. God, it stank, but his wounds felt better. The paste had eaten through his shirt, but it seemed to be repairing his wounds. He stood, then instantly collapsed back to the gel cot. Not quite 100%.
Take it easy.
It was the man who had incapacitated him. David scanned the room for a weapon. The spear was gone.
Relax. I'm not going to hurt you. At first I assumed they sent you to kill me. But when I saw your wounds, I figured they would have sent someone in better health.
David scrutinized the man, and he was a man. David could see that now. He was in his late 40s or maybe early 50s. His face was haggard, as if he hadn't eaten or slept much for some time. But it was more than that. The man's face was hard. A soldier, maybe a mercenary. Who are you? David got another whiff of the black goo on his shoulder and turned his head, trying in vain to get away from it. And what have you done to me?
Frankly, I'm not even sure. It's some kind of medicinal paste. It seems to be able to heal just about anything. I don't know how it works, but it does. I injured myself, was laid up and thought I might die. The computer opened a panel with a plate of this stinking stuff, then showed a movie of me putting it on. It was very realistic, so I did, and I got better, quickly. You'll be right as rain soon, maybe within a few hours.
Really? David studied the wounds.
Perhaps sooner. It's not like you're going anywhere. Now tell me who you are.
David Vale.
Organization?
Clock Tower. Jakarta Station, David said, automatically. The man stepped closer to David and drew a pistol. David realized what he had said. No, I was working against the Amari. I just now found out that Clock Tower was their organization.
Bullshit. How did you find me?
I didn't. I'm not looking for you. Hell, I don't even know who you are.
What are you doing down here? How did you get here?
The tunnels under Gibraltar. I found a chamber. With the spear.
How?
A journal. David shook his head, trying to think. The paste was like having a cold. It was hard to put his thoughts together.
Got it in Tibet, from a monk.
You know about it?
Of course I do. I wrote it.
Chapter 123. Kate heard the sound of hissing air all around her. She still couldn't feel her body, but the air was warm. Only a little warm at first, but it grew warmer with every passing second. She tried to push up off the floor, but she fell back face first. She was so tired. She let her limp body collapse into the frigid suit. Gradually the warmth filled the suit, and the feeling returned to her body. They, whoever they were bringing her body temperature up. The fog on the helmet's face mask turned to drops of water that ran down in streaks, and a view of the floor materialized in lines, like a shredded picture being reassembled, one skinny strip at a time. It was a metal grate, except she couldn't see through it. No, it was a solid metal floor with dimples. She turned over onto her back and stared at the smooth iron ceiling. The fog was receding now. It still felt cool, but it was downright balmy compared to the ice cathedral outside. Where was she? Some sort of decontamination chamber? Kate sat up. She could feel her fingers now, and she began fiddling with the clamps at her wrists. After some effort, the gloves came off, and she worked at the helmet. 10 minutes later, she was free of the suit and standing in the clothes she had left Gibraltar in. She surveyed the room. It was well lit, about 40 feet wide, and probably twice as long. Behind her, she saw the enormous door she had entered through. It was much larger than the door at the other end. She walked deeper into the room, and the smaller door opened. She walked through it, and lights popped to life at the ceiling and floor. Each light was faint, but taken together they shed more than enough light on the gray iron corridor. They reminded her of the running beads of light in the floor of a limo. She was standing in a giant T-intersection. Which way to go? Before she could decide, she heard something moving toward her. Footsteps. Chapter 124. David tried to make sense of what the man had said. His head was a haze from the nano-paste that was repairing the wounds in his shoulder and leg and racking his nostrils with its foul odor. The man claimed to be Patrick Pierce, Tom Warner, Kate's father, and the author of the journal. An American soldier who had dug the tunnels for the Amari in exchange for permission to marry the daughter of one of their leaders. But he couldn't be. The timeline was wrong, although he had spent time in those Atlantean stasis tubes. Did it add up? Could he be telling the truth? David tried to piece together what he knew. From 1917 to 1918, Patrick Pierce recovers from World War I wounds and discovers the Atlantis structure under Gibraltar, uncovering the Bell and unleashing a deadly epidemic, sold to the world as Spanish flu. Between 50 and 100 million people die. Up to a billion are infected on every continent. In 1918, Pierce puts his wife, Helena, and his unborn child inside a tube. From 1918 to 1938, Pierce becomes an unwilling member of the Amari leadership in order to protect his wife and unborn child. He finishes his excavation at Gibraltar, but he too is placed in a tube when Conrad Kane embarks on his expedition, first to Tibet to recover artifacts and massacre the Amaru, then to Antarctica to find what he believes is the Atlantis capital city. Kane never returns. In 1978, after 40 years, Mallory Craig, Patrick Pierce, and Dieter Kane are awakened from the tubes. Pierce's wife is still dead, but the child is born. Pierce names her Catherine Warner. The others take new names. Patrick Pierce becomes Tom Warner, Mallory Craig becomes Howard Keegan, and Dieter Kane becomes Dorian Sloan. In 1985, Tom Warner, Patrick Pierce, goes missing, possibly killed in a research experiment. Could it be true? Could Patrick Pierce, Tom Warner, have been down here since 1985? Assuming Pierce was in his mid-20s during World War I, as the journal said, he would have been in his mid-40s in 1938 when he went into the tube. That would make him around 52 in 1985 and 80 today. The man before him was much younger, possibly no more than 50. David was already feeling better from the paste. He stood, and the man raised the gun.
"Stay where you are. You don't believe me, do you?"
It's hard to argue when you're wounded and your captor has a gun, David thought. He shrugged and looked sheepish.
"I believe you. Don't be cute, and stop lying to me.
Look, I'm just trying to put it together. The journal was 1918 to 1936.
I know the journal dates.
You'll recall that I wrote it.
Now tell me exactly how you got down here."
David sat back on the bed. "I was lured into a trap by Mallory Craig, director of Clock."
"I know what he directs. What was the lure?"
The man spoke quickly, trying to corner David, hoping he would make a mistake and reveal himself to be a liar. "Kate Warner. He told me she had gone into the tombs. I went to find her. They took two children from her lab in Jakarta about a week ago. They were treated with a new autism therapy."
"What the hell are you talking about?"
"I'm not sure. She won't tell me."
"Kate Warner is a 6-year-old girl. She doesn't have a lab in Jakarta or anywhere else."
David appraised the man. He believed what he was saying. "Kate Warner is a genetics researcher, and she's definitely not 6 years old." The man lowered the gun and looked down and away.
"Impossible," he mumbled.
"Why?"
"I've only been down here a month."
Chapter 125. Kate could barely believe her eyes.
Addy and Surya ran around the corner, and upon seeing Kate, ran even faster toward her. Kate bent to hug them, but the boys barely stopped. They tugged at her arms, urging her to follow them.
"Come on, Kate. We have to go. They're coming."
Chapter 126. Dorian unlatched the orange harness and dropped the remaining 3 feet to the ice below.